name is Faith, and I am an alcoholic. With the fog in my throat, excuse me. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Patty G.
Hi, I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety day is March 19, 2012. Hilda F. is my sponsor, and you guys are my home group. That's right. Sobriety Sisters in the back. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. I definitely am not the same woman that I was when I walked in here. I was completely violent, wanted to kill myself on a daily basis, couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And I never knew what was going to be able to change in my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God you guys wrapped your arms around me, you know what I mean? So what it was like, you know, like I was raised up in West Hollywood. I'm an LA girl, born and raised, and I know that's like rare. There's like five people clapping here. Nobody's from LA. But yeah, so I, you know, my mom and my dad were together. I have two older sisters, and my grandmother would be here from Guatemala, and she would come and take care of us and raise us up. And my dad loved to drink. He loved that Budweiser, and he worked at a pharmacy, and he would pop those pills, and he would drink, and he never knew who was coming home at night. You know, it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and some days he would come in, and it was cool, but some days he would come in, and he would be completely violent, and he would beat up on my mom, and my mom would beat up on us, and I would really get beat up because I'm the youngest, but I learned how to fight back, you know? But yeah, that's how it pretty much was. And when my grandmother passed away, my parents split up and my mom remarried to my stepdad. And my stepdad loved to drink too. He loved to drink and he loved to smoke weed. And I loved that he liked to smoke weed because he would go to McDonald's and he'd get me a little Happy Meal and I would love it. And it was all good. It was cool. You know, we moved to South Central and then after the riots, we had to move and we went from one hood to the next. So now I'm in Inglewood. And in Inglewood, you know, I went to private Catholic school my whole entire life. And all right, one person. And I loved it. I loved it, and I wanted to be a good girl. I didn't want to be that bad girl. I thought that, you know, I would never do this, and I would never do that, and I would pride myself in being like some type of angelic person, but deep down inside, there was something going on, you know, and I was always pretty much angry. I used to go home from school, and then something would bother me, and I would break all my belongings. I remember just being completely violent, and this is before I even drank anything, and I would bite my nails down till they bled, and it was crazy. And at 10 years old, my mom had her 40th birthday party, and it was on and cracking, guys. The whole block party came out, and they were playing that music, they were doing that barbecue, and it was fun, and I loved it, you know, and I was minding my own business, and I sat inside, and the neighbor molested me that night. And the reason why I bring that up to you guys is because there's something that I use that situation and situations that would happen to me to make you feel sorry for me, and I would be a victim for my entire life until I read my fifth step. And there's something that transforms you. You know, if you've never done inventory before, you are in for it. You know what I mean? There's something magical that happens, and I let go of that whole situation, and I realized what my part was. And that night, me and my sister went out to the front of the building. We had some wine coolers. We went to that cooler and grabbed some wine coolers that looked like punch, and I was ready to drink. We went to the front, and then we got those beaties. They look like joints, but they're not joints, and I was hitting that beatie, and I was drinking that wine cooler, and I was like, hell yeah. And I don't know about you guys, but I've heard a lot of people talk about growing taller, boobs getting big, all these things happening. None of that happened, but what did happen was I wanted to go right back to the cooler. And I was going to get myself some more to drink. And I did. And I didn't become like an alcoholic overnight, but anytime I could get my hands on anything, I was drinking it, I was doing whatever it was. And I graduated high school at 17, and I went to Cal State Northridge, and the party was on. And I was drinking, like, it was like, first it was like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, then it was like Margarita Monday, Taco Tuesday, Wet Wednesday, you know how it is. So now I'm drinking all the time. And I can't, like, go through life without having something, because I am uncomfortable, you know what I mean? I'm not comfortable with who I am. I'm not comfortable with what, you know, the things that had happened to me. I just want relief all the time. And that's all I know, and that's all I want, and I was okay with that. And I didn't see myself having a problem. I thought I was having, like, the college experience. I thought that's what everybody did. And I was completely fine with it, and then I started losing friends left and right. Because when I drink now, I'm Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I become a violent person. I either want to sleep with your boyfriend, or I want to put holes in the wall. And I'm driving drunk on the streets of L.A. at night. I can't see, putting that one hand over my eye, and just, like, it's crazy out here. But that's what normal life is. And I run out in the morning and I look at my car to see if there's blood on the car, because I don't know what happened last night, you know? And I got to call you to find out what happened. And I'm full of apologies, constantly full of apologies, you know? People get tired of hearing that crap. And I don't mean what I say, you know what I mean? I'm just apologizing just to, let's just get past this, you know? It won't happen again. But it happens again and again and again. And sooner or later, I'm by myself. And I graduate college by the skin of my teeth, you guys. I don't know how I did it, but I graduated, and I started working in a group home for kids who are probation and foster youth, and I'm a total hypocrite. You know what I mean? Like, I am a total, complete hypocrite, and I'm going to the Food for Less, and at that time, I was so crazy. I would go there to go get my wine, because red wine, I heard, if you drink it, you don't get cancer. But at the same time, I'm at home, and I'm looking up online cyanide poisoning and different ways to kill myself so it didn't look like I committed suicide, because I don't want you to know that I'm weak. And the last time I drank, it was St. Patty's Day, 2012, and I waited all week, and I was, like, telling God, like, please, God, like, I need to, like, I'm going to be 30, I need to change my life. And I waited till that day, till Saturday, and I drank everything you think of, and I drank a shot of vodka at a friend's house. I remember I was in and out of a blackout, and I wake up, and there's water hitting me all over, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? And I had crashed into a fire hydrant, and I was like, I got to get out of here. So I start to trudge the road of Happy Destiny, because I live one block away. And I left my purse in the car, so then I have to come back. I go, and then the cops are there, and I'm like, you know, it's me. And it's clear that it's me. I'm soaking wet, and I go to jail. And I'm in jail, and then, you know, like, the hookers are in there, the ladies of the night, whatever you want to call them. And they're giving me legal advice, and I'm like, you hosts are in here, too. Like, I don't even understand. But I'm going to tell you what, you guys, they were walking out one by one, and I was still in there. And the book talks about, like, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I didn't have to look that up, you know what I mean? I didn't need to look that up, because I knew what that feeling was. I knew what that felt like when I walked out and I saw my mom and my sister waiting for me. And I went home and I told them I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, and I want to kill myself on a daily basis, and they were depressed. But I needed them to go, because I had some weed left, and I was going to hit that weed, and it all was going to be well. And it didn't happen like that. I came to you guys on a Friday, and I'll tell you what, I came in here and I didn't think that this program was going to work for me. I thought that it worked for you, but I saw something different happening to you guys that I did not know what that feeling was. And I was completely afraid to surrender fully. I would come to the meetings, I would get your little commitment, but I didn't get a sponsor. And when I finally got that sponsor, she took me through those steps, and my life started to change. You know what I mean? If you're new in here and you think this is unrealistic, believe me, there is somebody in here who has been through what you've been through, and you have nothing to be afraid of. You know what I mean? You have a opportunity for a completely different life, a life that you can't even imagine. And that may sound cheesy to you, but trust and believe, it is true. It is. I could see it in people. I'm looking out at you guys, and I see miracles in this room right now. People that I know their stories, and I've seen the things that have happened, and I know that it's possible. And for a person who wanted to kill themselves on a daily basis, I mean, I wake up and I pray, you know what I mean? I pray to God and I say, you know, thank you for having me to be able to wake up for another day. When I used to curse God, I used to be like, you know what, please take me out. I'm done with this. You know what I mean? I want to be done. I'm over it. And but I don't do that anymore, you know, and that is a miracle. I don't have like the fancy car and the hot man and all that stuff. But I'll tell you what, there is a lot of stuff that has changed in the inside that sometimes, and I mentioned this the other night, sometimes I look at myself and I hear myself talking and I don't even know that it's me. You know what I mean? And we're very lucky to be here. You know, and during these times, like, it was challenging. Like, I was afraid that I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, can you stay sober, blah, blah, blah. But then I think about things like all the things that we've been through together in this group, all the things that we've seen, the tragedies that we've seen, the victories that we've had. We've all managed to be able to stay here and do it all together, you know. And we did it on Zoom together. Some people on Zoom, shout out to my sponsor who's on Zoom tonight. We do it together, you know what I mean? And I, during the pandemic, like, I was fortunate enough to be able to have a meeting 2 days a week at my friend Ruben L's house. And I would walk over to that house, and there was just a group of guys and one woman, Rose. And sometimes Katia was there. Shout out to Katia in the back. And my sister Grace would come on Sundays. And it was just literally like we were there doing this together. And I felt like even in this hopeless time, like there was some hope there, you know? And so it's like, again, if you're going through something and you feel like you don't have any hope, there is hope here. And I hope that you guys keep coming back and find what we found here, because there's a lot of good stuff to get. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Christopher H.
Thank you. Awesome. Hello, Christopher Alcoholic. Hello, Zoom. How many people tonight, Bruce? It was like, I was on there last week. There was like 600 people on Zoom. Yeah, 600. It's a lot. It's cool to be here. Pacific Group's my home group. And I'm a grateful alcoholic today. It's interesting. You know, I got the tap on the shoulder before by Steve. Thank you very much, Steve. It's a real honour to be here. You just sort of like contemplate for a second, and I was sort of just thinking, you know, what is it to be an alcoholic? Because I say that, like, I'm Christopher, I'm an alcoholic, and I feel like one of the most important things for me is what even is that? Like, why over 10 years am I still coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous? Why am I still showing up? Like, why am I still trying to do this thing, like, 10 years on? Because I am so far removed from the chaos of drinking. Like, that was such a long time ago that why am I still here? Why am I an alcoholic? What even is an alcoholic? And I think the interesting thing is, you know, like Clancy said, that for alcoholics, the problem starts once we put the drink down. And I can be, you know, 10 years removed from the chaos of drinking, but I can still have all this carnage and chaos in my life sober, because I think that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And I remember when I used to drink, and drinking seemed to work like a solution. I remember that basically the world would just be dark. And it was almost like the demons were hiding in the darkness and in the closet, and my anxiety and my paranoia was just like peaking, and I was just petrified to go out into the world to walk into my job, I'd be crying in the shower because I was so terrified to go to work. And I was so ashamed for all of the terrible things that I had done that I couldn't look you in the eye. And I'd take one drink of alcohol, and it would just wash it all away. You know, I'd take one drink of alcohol and I could finally breathe, like, oh. And then the city lights come on and it's like if I could just stop at that, I wouldn't need to be here. But my problem is, you know, the book speaks about we have this physical compulsion to continue to drink. Once we have one drink, it sets off like an allergy, like some people are allergic to nuts. My friend a couple of days ago drank some nut milk and he couldn't breathe. Like, it set off like an allergic reaction. And like, for us, you know, for me, alcohol is like that. It sets off this thing where, to me, it feels like there's this like flame on the inside, and I just have to continue to keep putting fuel on the fire. You know, it's like, you know, those old trains that have the coal trains or whatever, and they're like shoveling like the coal into the train to like keep it going. It's like, that's what it feels like. I have to keep going. Like, I cannot stop. I'm at a party with my friends and I look around and they've all gone to sleep. And I'm sitting up and I need more, like, and you cannot stop me when I am on a spree. Like, you can't, like, I need to get to the end. The Bill Wilson spoke about seeking oblivion. No, like, I seek oblivion. I need to knock myself out and you cannot stop me. And when I'm there, like, it's like the Wild West almost. Like, I don't care about rules or like this or like that. It's like a need. It's such insanity. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And when I graced you with my presence in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it was like back in like, I don't know, 2010 or something like this. You know, I got to the end of the line, and it was pretty much, yeah, it was just like the train had sort of got to the last stop, and it was over. I'd used up all my party tickets, and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember the first thing is like seeing the steps on the wall. And it was like the Gaelic writing, you know what I mean? Like, with God and the Gaelic writing. And you know, I eventually got a sponsor, and that was one of the first things he said to me was, Christopher, you're just thinking about you. And he said, what we're trying to achieve here, what we're trying to do is we're trying to turn that out, so you can start to think about others. What you need to do is you need to get a tea towel and wash the coffee cups. It's like, okay, so I got the tea towel, and we do the meeting, and after the meeting I'm washing the coffee cups. I wash those coffee cups for 6 months, and it was the first time in my life that I had ever done anything without wanting something in return. And then after 6 months of coffee cups, then it was 6 months where I like had to bring the food and like make sandwiches and this stuff. And it's like a year. And then after this, it was another 6 months. And like, I couldn't miss that meeting. You know, we used to show up late. You know, you're like 5 minutes late, and all the old timers would be standing there, like tipping your watch. They're all like calling you all week, checking in on you. You know, you're calling your sponsor. I used to pray that he wouldn't answer the phone. I had no money. I'm like searching couches for like trying to find a 50-cent piece or whatever to go make the phone call. Like, please don't answer. Please don't answer. Please don't answer. He's like, Christopher. Like, oh my God. And You know, like the next thing I did was like literature. I had to like bring the literature every week. 6 months ago, like a year and 6 months. You know, the next thing was like a greeting. I had to greet 6 months for greeting. You know, the next thing I was like secretary. That was a year. You know, next thing I've got like three years. Then it was GSR. That was a 2 year commitment. You know, the next thing, like I've got 5 years sobriety. And I think like, you know, today I have to keep coming back here. Like I have to continue to do this thing. Like I'm not cured of alcoholism. I'll never be cured. I have to continue to try my best to keep coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to try to find a way to give back. Because I believe that like AA is the greatest catch-22 of all time. That's my belief. It's like AA will give you everything. I remember I had about 1 or 2 years and AA had given me my life back. You know, like I wasn't drinking, I was sober, I got a job, like I could clean my teeth, I could like wash my clothes, things like this. But I didn't want to give back. Like I didn't care enough about you to actually call you or want to help you or take you through the steps. And I suffered. I suffered and it hurt me until it forced me through pain. The book talks about pain, the touchstone of all spiritual growth, and it forced me to start to learn how to help other people. And today, like I'm not perfect, you know, we aren't saints. But I need to continue to try to find ways in Alcoholics Anonymous to give back, and it can be simple or big or small, and I do that. And you know, today, what did Clancy used to say? Sane and happy and all these things, safe, and like I have that. but yeah, thank you for having me.
Our main speaker tonight is John G.
My name is John Graff, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Peter. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you. You know, I was thinking about it tonight. I was sitting out in the parking lot. Used to sit out in the parking lot and wait for my sponsor for many, many years with Johnny, and then Tim and Charles joined us later on and reflected on that and what that man did for me and did for my life and altered my life and, you know, everybody really sitting in this meeting tonight. And if you're new here tonight and, you know, well, let's put it this way. If you identify with anything I got to say, you're a sick son of a bitch, and you better get busy real quick. Let's get that out of the way. And you better jump in, and you better get a sponsor and a book and not leave here tonight without either one of them. If you don't relate to the first two 10-minute speakers, Patty, thank you. Christopher, I think you needed a few more sayings, you know, to rip off there. Just saying. What? What? Huh? What? AA is going to turn you into a person that you're probably sitting next to tonight if you're new, and you're probably just hating on them. Really, I'm here to tell you. We recently lost my dog the day after Christmas, and I was gutted. I was like torn up about this, and I reflected back of being brand new in meetings, and some, you know, elder lady sharing about Fluffy dying in the noon eating meeting. And I was like, who gives a crap about Fluffy? I'm trying to get laid after the meeting, you know? I mean, come on, Grandma, let's speed it up. I got some wisdom to break out here, you know? I've been reading the book a little bit. But I was like, Jesus Christ, AA has turned me into Grandma, you know? I mean, I'm just like, I was like gutted. And then I called my friend Larry Thomas. That's a bad thing. Just let's get that out of the way, first of all. Who, by the way, he's at the Temptations tonight. He's not ate the Grateful Dead this week. But I was like, yeah, I just need a friendly voice. Larry said, well, good luck, you know, and just, you know, keep going. But I wasn't an alcoholic when I got here. I wasn't. And you know, I didn't have a lot of the experiences that Patty or Christopher were talking about. I'm just this skinny little kid. I'm the baby of the family. I'm, you know, we're in the projects in Kansas City, Missouri. You know, I'm this little kid. Everybody's older than me. Drinking wasn't a big thing in our family, you know. I mean, just wasn't. I've always been a people watcher. Like, I've always, like, sat back and watched, like, scoped out the room, not in a creepy kind of way, you know, just like watch my lay, you know, watch what's going down. And what happened was, you know, I don't know, I was about five, and I don't look like anybody in the family. They're all bigger, big boned, you know. I'm a skinny little kid, big head, you know, buck teeth, big ears. And my brother then proceeded to tell me that I wasn't a graft, that they found me at the dump. Now, I don't know what that does for you about four or five, you know, but I was a little crushed. So I go to my mom. Now, to let you know that I have alcoholism and not alcoholism, and that part in the book talks about where, you know, the problem centers in our mind, I didn't have to have any explanation about that. People have looked at me. You know, if you're new here tonight, I'm not going to set the bar real high, you know, like a lot of the speakers do. I just aren't. You need a ride to court tomorrow? I'm going, so you can jump in the car with me. We can carpool together, you know. I'm not that guy, you know. I have struggles. I don't know what the hell Christopher was talking about, you know. I'm like, I'm struggling now, you know. But I'm sitting here, and I can go through anything and not have to drink. I know that. Where I was a slave to alcohol. So when I, at five or six, if love could have fixed me, my mom would have fixed me that day. My mom would have made everything all right, because she was like, Johnny, you're a graph. You were planned. You were named after your uncle, your grandfather. You were this, you were that. Now, if love could have fixed me, she did exactly what a mother should do, you know? And I said this before, you could put this on my gravestone. He thought he was right, because that is my life story. You know, I believe my brother. I don't believe my mother. And I can prove this about, I don't know, 10 years ago, I had a little business with a partner of mine. The job was going crazy. I had the plans out on the kitchen table. That dog that passed away would come over and he would sit his head on my lap. And I'm going, Max, go on, leave me alone, man. And he would go away for a couple minutes and he'd come back. He'd put his head on my lap. And I'd, Max, leave me alone, man. Like, my wife was laying on the couch about 5 or 10 minutes of this crap. And he comes back and I'm like, dude, just leave me alone. What's the matter with you? And my wife says to me, she says, what is so broken in you that you can't see he's trying to comfort you? He knows you're in pain and he's trying to comfort you. What's wrong with you? And I looked at my wife and I said, what's wrong with you? Shut up. Leave me alone. Like, can't you see I'm in pain here? Like, what? I did too, like Patty, I did Catholic schooling for 12 years, not that you could tell. I'm the stereotypical rotten, I'm just the rotten little Catholic kid. That's what I am. And what happened is at 6, my dad was back in our life for a minute. My sister was getting married and we were at her wedding and my brother said, go steal the punch bowl. I went and stole the punch bowl. I don't know what it took for you to take your first drink, but that's all it took for me. And what it did for me at the age of 6 is what it did for me at the age of 26 when I showed up into these rooms. It didn't matter what was going down in my life. Much like Christopher talked about, after I got enough alcohol in me, it just shut it down. I didn't care. My dad was back in our life. My dad's idea of time out or talking things out, you know, as he was whipping your ass with one hand, he would say, now, do you understand? And he'd start in on the other. And that was my dad's idea of, you know, time out or any of that. And I was deathly afraid of my old man. Deathly afraid of my old man. And alcohol did its job. At the age of 6, I didn't care whether he caught me or not. Now, I was throwing a lot of other things on it at the end of my drinking, and I'm not somebody that'll sit here and stand here and tell you that alcohol quit working for me. Because I know alcohol, to this day, and that's the problem that centers in my mind, to this day, I know what'll make the big hurt go away. I know that it will do that. The thing that AA has done is given me a different set of tools to apply in my life. The thing that AA has done is give me a sponsor to supersede my thoughts with his own thoughts and actions. And if you listen to my story, you'll hear it and how it transformed my life. I've done nothing. I've burned it to the ground. I came to you with it in a bag, a little black bag, in a bad attitude. That's what I did. That's what I showed up into the rooms with. And then, after I get a little something, do I think I got something coming to me? What happened for me is, I'm a thief. I love stealing. I love stealing your car and seeing your face as I steal your car. You know, as my friend Frank Jones used to say, if I go into a store and I come out with the item and the money in my pocket, I'm a double winner, you know? And it always made sense to me. And what happened for me is we were stealing these cars in this little one-dog town that we had moved to. And I'm the kid that's already been through the system as a juvenile, you know, and now I'm going to look at bigger time, and it ain't my idea of a good time. It's just not. I don't like getting locked up. I don't like being around men all that much. I like women, you know, and I'm just like, yeah, I grab a girlfriend and another friend, and I flee to the state of Texas. And the thing that's going on in the state of Texas at that time was the drinking age was 18. I didn't have a job. I didn't have family. I didn't know anything about the state of Texas other than the drinking age was 18. And I was going to Texas. And I landed in Corpus Christi in this little industrial part, a little cockroach-infested place in Corpus Christi. Me and the friend got in a fight. He moved out. The girlfriend got pregnant, and I was ecstatic about having this little girl. I was excited about having this little girl. I know nothing about having a little girl. But the way I'm living my life, and I didn't learn this until I did that stupid thing called an inventory later on, was I'm living my life based off of these two emotions. I'm living my life off of this self-centered fear. And it's not the kind of fear where I sit there and suck my thumb and sit in a corner. I have the kind of fear that I'm going to do outlandish crap so you don't know that I'm afraid. If it takes me to drive on two wheels on a car, if jump off a 75-foot cliff into the water, whatever it is, I'm going to do that so you know I'm not terrified. That's the way I'm living my life. But on the other side of that, and I still struggle with this today, is that false pride. And that false pride looks like this to me. I can't tell you I don't know how to take care of a little girl. I can't tell you that I'm afraid of raising this little girl. I can't tell you I don't know how to make formula. I don't know how to change a baby. I don't know how to open a bank account. I don't know where you buy formula. And the crap just goes on in my head like that. And I go to the cantina, and I have a couple pitchers of beer. I sing Vicente Fernandez, Dos Mujeres, Un Camino. And I'm on, man. I'm on. I'm excited. I am on. This old man was running the pool table that night, and I got a decision that night. I was going to roll this old man out of his pension check, his Social Security check. I don't know what it was. But I was going to roll this old man out of his money, send the girlfriend home to her mother, and join the military. And as a result of my military career, which lasted 11 months and 3 days, I can never step foot on a military installation the rest of my adult life. And I don't know about you, but this was one of the things where I saw kids from the neighborhood, more my brother's friends than mine, where they would get in trouble back in those days, and you had a chance of going to prison, or you had a chance of going to the military. And guys would go to the military and come back home 3 months later, they'd be pressed and creased, they'd have money in their pocket, have a purpose in their step, and they'd have a drive. And that's what I was going to do. I thought I was right. I thought I was right. 11 months and 3 days later, you know, I'm bad conduct discharged and I'm out of there. And in about that same time, in about a 5 minute drunken phone call, that little girl that I was so excited about, I dismissed her out of my life in about a 5 minute drunken phone call. And I would love to sit here and blame that on alcohol and drugs. I almost died in these rooms behind that lie. Because there's a lot of stuff on that fourth and fifth step, just on the way to get well, just on the way to get right and not have those feelings and those emotions and that crap running my life. I didn't need a drink to act like that. I didn't need drugs to act like that. I had transformed somewhere in that to this, I don't even know what it was. You know, some people call it an animal. I've seen animals with more compassion than that. And I don't stand here to try to be some podium killer or anything. That's just the reality of where I was at. At the end of my drinking, my kids started drinking and using. I'm sending them to school to sell dope for me. I'm ripping them off. They're ripping me off. Nobody taught me how to do that. I'm a scumbag at best. I am a scumbag at best. I came up with that idea all by myself. You know. The end of my drinking, I was a Teamster. I had made top of Teamster's pay. And And I watched this friend of mine get hurt, and he started this sideline business, and we were over there supporting his sideline business. And he gets up on his crutches, and he goes out to the mailbox. He gets this little check. He comes back. I said, what the hell is that about? He goes, well, I got hurt. So they send me this check every 2 weeks. I said, I think I'm hurt. And I started sending my kids to school, sell dope for me. And I have moved from the city to the country to deeper in the country to back in the city. I'm in Northern California. I'm in West Sacramento. And it's just crazier and crazier and crazier. And one night after another fight with me and the little woman, I walk into the bedroom, I throw some things in a little black bag, and I walk out. And I go down, and I sit down on this crossroads, and I said to myself, I said, what the hell am I going to do now? And something said, go to the right. I'm not going to try to explain it. I'm not going to try to define it. But straight ahead was the park, and there was always something going on there. To the left was Shovelhead's house, and there was always something going on there. Behind me was my own house, and there should have been a revolving door as many times as we've been through this dance of death. I picked up that bag and went to the right. I ended up out at this truck stop that I used to do business out of, and I'm asking them for a ride home. And they ain't having nothing to do with my yellowish-green butt. At the end of my drinking, I'm 110 pounds, I get yellowish-green, I got open sores all over my body. And the only thing I got going on is I'm having a cash flow problem. That's the only thing I got going on. I'm waiting for the next deal to go down. And that's who I am. I'm waiting for the next deal. I do what all guys of my caliber do about 2 or 3 in the morning. I call mom, collect, just to see what she's doing, check in. And I said, you know, I just left Judy and the boys and I want to come home. And I'd heard through the grapevine that that brother that hates me got sober in something called A&A. And what happened for me is I said to my mom, I said, why don't you bring Jeff with you and maybe I'll go into treatment. And this is 1988 or 87 actually, because 88's my sober date. And it's right after the Super Bowl. And I'm so tore up. I'm wearing a Washington Redskins shirt, sitting in the Denver airport, just babbling madness about John Elway's sexuality and trying to make friends. And I come into St. Louis, Missouri, into this worst storm they'd had in, I don't know, 20 years, and my brother and my mother were there to pick me up. And my brother, God bless him, was in his evangelical stage of sobriety, and he proceeded to tell me where I was going to go and what I was going to do and what I was going to do once I got there and how long I was going to be there. And so he took a breath, and I proceeded to tell him where he could go and where he could put it and how much fun he was going to have once he put it there. And next thing I know, Captain Serenity's pulling the car over on I-70 and we're going to go to Fist City. I'm in town maybe 5 minutes. My little blue-haired mother could tell you to this day, I could piss off the Pope. And Captain Serenity's pulling the car over, and our little fat blue-haired mother sitting in the back with the rosary beads smoking, and she says, you know what, Johnny, why don't you go talk to these people, and if you ain't got a problem, you ain't got to do nothing about it. The funny thing is that little old lady is in my converted garage that my wife and I moved her in just before this whole thing broke down. And I don't have the same feelings. If you're sitting here new and you're wondering about all this crap and you hear, you know, oh, I feel blessed to be able to give this back to my mother. I feel cursed, man. I have to say the Serenity Prayer 100 times before I walk in there, before she shits on the floor, you know? And I'm like, don't feel blessed. I don't feel, oh, I'm fortunate. I didn't know what to do. I called Steve up. Steve gave me to his ex-wife. His ex-wife navigated me through all of the stuff to do for my mom. I'd be lost. It's so funny if you're in here tonight. I was talking to Mike outside. Mike was talking, his daughter's trying to get into medical school. He goes, you know, I tell my daughter, if she's got a problem, just ask me, and I could call anybody in AA and get her the right answer. You know, my cynical ass is, yeah, well, you better watch the answer you're getting from in who, you know? And Mike's like, no. And that's right. He's 100% right. If you hang around with the people that are doing this thing, you'll get the right answer. I went the next day and, you know, in that place that I hated, the magic of AA, as my sponsor used to claim, happened for me. In this stupid thing called group. Because I'm not a talker. If you ain't figured it out, if I get off this podium and don't drop an F-bomb, I'm a success. I'm not a talker. I'm not. This is me at the beginning. I sit in group. I sit in the same chair, in the same corner, at the same table, with the same ashtray. They're all chit-chatting it up, you know, let go, let God. Oh, we're learning to, you know, we're learning to take life on life's terms, Dave. Oh, Dave, it's, you know, it's in the giving that is the gift, Dave. I'm not talking. I'm not talking. I don't care if you got pictures. I'm not talking. I'm sitting in a corner. Somebody gets real in group, and the best I can do for sharing, bam, I hit my head on the wall. And Dave knows that he's hit a chord with me. And he's like, you want to share, John? Bam, bam. Thanks for sharing. Keep coming back. And then he'd go on to the next guy. That's my extent of shares in group. One day we're sitting in group, and Conrad had been in this place, no exaggeration, at least 10 times. He did it longer than I did. He did it harder than I did. Conrad lets out this dramatic outburst in group about the last time he was there, he left his youngest kid as collateral on a deal so he could go get the money and come back and finish the deal. And that was my moment of identification. I could yeah, but you, I could make wise-ass excuses. I could dispute anything you had to say. It's, as my old sponsor used to say, it's anybody's fault but mine. It ain't my fault. I don't know. It ain't me. It may look like me, but it ain't me. But that day of identification, I couldn't dispute it. I couldn't wave it away. I couldn't make an excuse. Now, to let you know how alcoholism works in my head, is it sat there for the next 2 days wondering who in my life called Conrad up and told him what I had done 2,000 miles away so he could have this dramatic outburst in group so that I could walk across your bridge of identification and join your happy band of givers. That's how twisted my alcoholism trying to kill me is. And that's when I was brand new. And I got the best gift out there. To this day, I don't want to hear your scenarios. I want to hear the same jackpot that I'm in and how you got out of it. Don't tell me, and here's the beauty of it. During this whole COVID thing, I started going to this step meeting. And this guy, I just shared it tonight with one of the guys I sponsor. This guy is telling me about his fears. I'm sitting in this meeting, and on page 84, it talks about, now about step 10. We have fears. We go through our day. You know, we write them down. We talk about them with somebody. We give them to God, and we leave them alone. And this guy's sharing this in this meeting. And he goes, he's telling this newcomer, and the newcomer goes, okay, I've written it down. I've told you. I've given it to God. Now what do I got to do? And he's like, nothing. Go help somebody. He's like, no, you don't understand. I've written it down. I've told you. I've turned it over to God. Now what do I got to do? He's like, nothing. Go help somebody. About the fourth time, it was like somebody hit me with a bat. That's all you got to do. Just tell on yourself. Tell them that secret. Tell whatever it is. Let somebody else decide. Let God decide. I left that place, got an old redneck cowboy to be my sponsor back in the Midwest. Basically told me, he goes, I'll show you how to do it the way I do it. Kind of drugged me through the steps. And when I was about 3 years sober, I was married, had a little girl, had a stepson, and I was stark raving sober. I'd given AA all that I thought that it asked of me, and I wanted to eat a bullet, much like Patty talked about tonight. And I didn't need a bigger God. I needed to get smaller. I needed to get somebody that could know how I felt. Not give me some parrot crap from the podium. Not give me some parrot crap like, oh, do the third step. Well, how do you do it? I mean, give me the bones. Give me the nuts and bolts. Tell me what the hell to do here. Don't just parrot some shit at me. I've become friends with a lady named Karen Garrison, and she said, I told her myself. And she said, oh, honey, my sponsor would love to work with a jackass like you. I called that man up 2,000 miles away, sitting in my garage, and I made a deal. Whatever this man tells me to do, I'm going to try to do it. And for the best of my ability, I did do that. On his 35th birthday, I came out here. I was sitting at Ohio Street and had the thought and the feeling come over me that anything was possible here. And that's this group. That's Pacific Group. We started with a ragtag bunch of losers, people that couldn't stay sober anywhere, and I fit right in. I talked about this the last time I spoke. I went to a country club. My friend Keith P. was trying to qualify for an amateur, some crap. I don't know. I don't play golf. I don't give a crap chasing some little white ball. Shoot it. I like that, you know. Blow it up. That's, yeah. And so he says, hey, come on out there. And it turned out it was Byron's country club. Byron was at this thing. He said, hey, you know, I'm wearing a wife beater and painter's pants, and I think I got t-shirt on or something, you know. I mean, tennis shoes. He says, come on, I'm going to buy everybody lunch. I'll never forget this, because I was new around here. I was trying to fit in. Byron took us in there, and we're sitting there, and all of a sudden this head dude with all the crap on comes over and says, Mr. Waleen, Mr. Jones wants to bring to your attention that some of your guests are not dressed to club standard. And I know they're talking about me. I never need any explaining that somebody's like pissed at me. I don't, half the room right now is pissed, so, you know, whatever. Pray for me. I got a list. And I'm sitting there and I go, Byron, it's okay. I know. I'll leave. And he's like, no, you won't. No. He says, you tell Mr. Jones, I can't tell you what Byron said from the podium because I'd be breaking my rule of, I was like, whoa, Byron, like he was getting ghetto. Like, I mean, he went off on the maitre d', that's their name. And I was like, you tell Mr. Jones he can leave. And I was like, and I hadn't had that. I hadn't had that. I ended up splitting up with that lady, and I was kind of going to be an AA pimp around here and cut a weak one from the herd here and there and kind of like some of my babies. And not you, Mitch. And ended up starting dating this woman, and we'd break up, we'd get together, we'd break up. We had typical A romance. You hang up. No, you hang up. And, you know. And I was living with my friend Greg and his boy and my daughter Mary, and I can remember going to Clancy and talking about it, and he's like, you know, most healthy women want to be in a relationship, John, you know, and I was not down, but every time we would fight. And the thing about my wife, I could fight with anybody. I could fight with anybody. It doesn't matter. I kind of get off on it, right? But when I fight with her, it just destroys me. Like, I'm consumed. I'm consumed by it, you know? And so anyway, I popped the question to her on Christmas Day, and I said, look, I got conditions, you know? My kid's almost 16. I don't want any more kids, you know? I got, yeah, good, I don't got any, don't want any. I'm like, you're my girl. And 9 months later, you know, after our honeymoon, she wasn't feeling well, and I'll never forget it, man. I thought I was right. I thought I was right. And I ended up, you know, I got presented with this little 22.5-inch, 16.5-inch head, 10-pound baby boy, you know, and he's like a midget, you know, and we called him Buckethead in the sense because he was just, I mean, it helped him walk, you know, when he started to walk, like keep up with his head. And I'll never forget it. Frank Jones was the first one there that day. Greg Day and my daughter and Ethan were like towards the tail end. And that kid is, he's the most adult one in the whole family, really. Me and Mike were talking tonight, you know, he's pulling down a 4.0 during this whole pandemic and then through everything else. And he's just, he's like this old soul. And I thought I was right. I didn't want any kids, and I was wrong. I ended up, I had this little business with this partner of mine, and that went south, and so I started over, and I got this opportunity from a friend of mine. He said, hey, they're looking for somebody out there, you know, you ought to talk to them. And I talked to this guy, and you guy's a clown, and it was an insult. I go, don't you know who I think I am, you know, like, and I talked to Tim about it, because I started using Tim, And I'll never forget it. Tim was like, John, just take the job. Like, the money will come. I'm like, Tim, this is an insult. He's like, John, take the job. So I called the guy up. I started taking the job. The guy that they had was one of us without the program. And on a Zoom meeting, he gets all uppity and he says, if you don't like it, you can fire me. The guy goes, okay, I accept your resignation. And he like texts me. He's like, can you do the job? I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. He's like, can you build? I'm like, yeah, I can build, but I don't know what I'm doing as far as this work, you know. Don't worry. So he gets me another guy, and the other guy comes in, and so it's something's up. I can smell something's up, like something ain't right. And all of a sudden I figure out the guy's ripping him off. And I found out because the guy implicated me in the whole process. And I'm like, hey, dude, like, I called Tim up. Tim's like, you got to tell your boss. I'm like, Tim, I'm not a snitch, man. I don't, you know, come on. And he's like, look, if somebody stole Charles's truck, would you tell who it was if you knew? And I was like, well, that's different, you know. And he was like, no, it ain't, you know. So I'm like, God. So I call the guy, the owner up, and I tell him. Long story short, I'm now running the Northern Division of this company, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. We just won the highest GP rating, and been promoted to the construction manager. I'm like, I still don't know what the hell I'm doing. All I'm doing is what you guys taught me to do. That's all I'm doing, and construction, what I've been doing from jump. Because I thought I was being insulted by the start of this. thought I was right. 5:24 of 16, that little girl that grew up in these rooms, grew up in the yard, grew up, you know, talking smack with some of y'all's kids. She's a Navy pilot now. I'm proud as hell and scared as hell. 5:24 of 16, that little girl calls me up, and during the whole amends process, I've always had this thing about that daughter that I walked away from. And every sponsor I've had three different sponsors, and all three of them told me, leave her alone. She probably doesn't know about you. She's probably adopted. You know, none of them have had this experience, by the way. So if you're sitting here and you're interviewing sponsors or figuring out which meeting, you don't know your butt from a hole in the ground. So just, what does it care? Just jump in. Do what the hell we're doing, okay? The problem is they all told me to leave her alone. I hated the direction. I used to sit in these rooms. I'd hear other speakers talk about getting reunited with their daughters or sons and all of that, and I would hate on them. I followed the direction. 5:24 of 16, that little girl put out a message on Facebook to five people with the same last name as me, and one of them was my daughter. And 5:24 of 16, my daughter Mary contacted me about my daughter Jess. My daughter Jess was just over here at Christmas because she wants to come and hang out with these people. If you're new here tonight, I've gotten everything good and decent, and things that you can't, you sit there and scratch your head over and think, like, how in the hell did that even happen? And I can tell you, I'm not somebody that'll sit here and tell you, oh, I don't know how it happened. Yeah, I do. I followed the direction that I was given. I followed the direction. I didn't dispute whether you had that experience in your life. I just had the knowledge and the faith that you wanted the best for me. That's all Clancy ever wanted for me. It was the best for me. Any guy that had ever worked with me. And that's the same thing as with Tim. And that's the same thing for us to you. If you're new and you're trying to figure this thing out, there's nothing to figure out. You got to surrender to get in. And I hope you can do that. Thanks.